Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode of the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show. And today, and it's bright and early in the UK to make this happen, I am on with my friend from Brisbane, Australia, Lou Felton-Smith. Would you like to introduce yourself, darling?
I would love to. Hi. So it's, 3:40 in the afternoon here in Brisbane.
Yeah.
My name's Lou, as Kate has said, and I'm a survivor of domestic abuse myself. I escaped 8 years ago with a travel suitcase and my three older kids in tow. And I am now a mentor for women who have also experienced abuse. And I'm mentor women from a lived experience point of view, and I help them to navigate the post-separation phase with abusers, in particular mums who have kids with their abusers, which is a whole different ballgame. I actually created in my shower in 2020 a charity, which I didn't realise at the time would become a charity, called Miracle Mums Movement Inc. And we support and empower survivors of domestic abuse, and we take them out of the victim and trauma space and into post-traumatic growth so that they can live the life of their dreams.
Fabulous. So how have you found the kids have been since experiencing all that? Were they exposed to any of the domestic abuse?
Yeah, so that's an interesting story. That's my eldest, who was seven at the time, is the reason why I actually left in the end. So she was suffering from extreme mental illness. She was depressed. She was having suicidal thoughts at seven, which is quite horrific as a mother to hear that your daughter doesn't want to be here anymore. And it was in that moment when she was crying in my arms one night and she said, "I don't want to be here anymore." And that was my catalyst for leaving. I was like, this is not about me anymore. This is about her. This is about them. And I felt in that moment that that gave me permission to leave. That was my permission to go, because up until that point, I didn't feel as if I had a good enough reason. He was extremely verbally, psychologically, and emotionally abusive, but he never hit me. And it was because he never hit me that I stayed as long as I stayed, because I didn't think that I could explain it away as domestic violence, because he hadn't physically touched me. But I could notice in his behaviour that it was escalating. It was escalating from the verbal and emotional and psychological abuse into the property damage. He was intimidating me. He was coming up within an inch of mine and the kids' faces, screaming in our faces, you know, to the point where the kids were cowering in the corner. And it was starting to escalate into punching holes in walls. It was the, you know, throwing of furniture around the room, that real, you know, exerting control. This is what I can do if you push me, was the message I was getting loud and clear.
Yeah.
So from a mental health point of view, my 7-year-old was extremely unwell, as was I. My middle child was two at the time, She was also experiencing behavioural issues and extreme emotional outbursts over seemingly nothing. And my youngest was 4 months at the time. So he didn't sleep. He would only sleep when he was on my chest. Sorry, I can be emotional. he was not sleeping. I was not sleeping. He was really suffering because of the effects that it was having on me. And in comparison, the moment I decided to leave and the moment we walked out that door, it was like a cloud lifted. I suddenly felt so much clarity, so much joy and elation, so much relief. And my kids felt that as well. They felt that, and they felt those things as well. They were happy. My son started sleeping. He was a happy baby. He wasn't screaming anymore like he was when we were inside the abuse. It was like night and day. It completely changed all of our mental health in that second that we walked out.
I mean, all just to give context to the listeners, the punching of walls, getting right up to Lou's face, throwing things, those are classic fear in, that it's referred to as fear-induced compliance and fear-induced silence. So he's planting these seeds of fear. You don't know whether he's going to do it, but you don't know whether he won't. And you live with that fear. I know that's something that I always, you hear me say all the time, is that it was never what he said. The look had a greater impact on me than anything that came out of his mouth could have had. He could have threatened to unalive me, which he did do, and I would verbally challenge him back because I would operate from fight flight. But the look would make me back off. And I'm assuming that's exactly the same for you, was it, Lou?
Yeah, you've just reminded me as well that, you know, me trying to explain my experiences to the police, it was the tone. It wasn't the words that he said, it was the tone, and it was the fact that I knew the intention behind that tone. And you can't explain that to an outside party. And even to the point where we were in magistrate's court for a DVO, and I had a recording where he'd called me and screamed down the phone at me. He'd be holding my son and he wouldn't return him. He was breastfed. He was screaming in the background and he wouldn't bring him back. And I think from memory, the words that he said were, "You come and get him." But the police listening to that message heard the words, "Well, you come and get him." They were like, "Well, why didn't you go and get him?" Without realizing, and without me being able to communicate, that I was scared to go and get him. I was scared to go to his house. We hadn't been doing changeover at houses because I was scared of him, and I was scared of what he would do to me, what he would do to the kids. So we were doing changeovers at that point at the local shopping centre. So it wasn't the fact that he said, "Come and get him." That wasn't considered a threat, but it was the tone. "Will you come and get him then?" But they wouldn't let me play the audio of the recording. They would only read the transcript.
Yeah.
So you lost the tone, and I was not in a place where I was able to communicate effectively exactly what the meaning behind that tone was and why I was scared to go get him.
Yeah. And this is what you know, I try to put across in the professional training is when we're talking about the psychology of the perpetrator, you've also got to take into account understanding, and that's, unless you've heard a video or you've heard a voice recording, it's very difficult to understand and explain, or for the victim to explain. It's a tone, it's a hidden message that, oh, that means something, that only means something to the victim. They could give you a look out at a family gathering, and nobody would spot it. But it carries a hidden meaning to you. And you know, when you leave, you're in trouble. Or you could be on the phone, and it's the tone. It's never what they say, is it? It is a tone of voice that you know, oh, it's not going to be good, this. Yeah.
And so many times I've been asked, has he threatened you? Have you got evidence of a threat? And the answer is always no, because he's careful about what he says.
Yeah. And this is why I always say coercive control is, it's not black and white. You know, you can have all the understanding in the world on coercive control, but unless you've got physical evidence of a tone that somebody's using, of an example of that tone, it's very, very difficult to factor that into the evidence of coercive control. And that's why it is so hard to get a conviction on, and why we have to work even harder to prove it. It's just. So with the, obviously you said about the kids, I've this whole of October is going to be focusing on a lot on the effects of on children, which is why obviously I asked you about that. And it is really common for children to not be able to sleep, to have violent and aggressive outbursts as a result of the perpetrator's behavior. When you leave, you notice a significant difference. You won't notice, you know, everything change overnight, because they've got a lot of healing to do. And there is this, it will affect them, so depending on their age, will affect them for a long, 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 long time. It will take a lot of healing. The younger ones will recover a lot quicker. So obviously the one that was two would recover a lot quicker than the older ones. But when there's still contact, you still got those factors to play in, because what we don't know is how they are behaving behind closed doors when they are having visits. And they may be compliant and well-behaved with the other parent, and then come home and have those aggressive outbursts because that parent is their safe space. They feel safe enough to express how they feel. And that can be hard for some victims of domestic abuse, is grasping and getting their head around, well, why is he good? Why are they good for when they go to dad's? But when they come back to me, they act out, they're badly behaved, they're aggressive, and is it something that I'm doing? Am I the problem? No, actually, you're their safe space. They feel safe enough to express how they feel with you. And when they go to dad's, they're going to shut down. They drop down into freeze, and they become submissive, because they know that they have to submit. So we're going to just break for a short interval, and we will move on with this conversation.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If optimising your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at, and with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. And we're going to look at Lou's experiences working within the charity, domestic abuse charity space. So what are your experiences, Lou? How are you finding the victims that are coming through the door and reaching out for help and support?
Yeah, so I guess that's an interesting one because we have always been very careful to market ourselves as a non-crisis service. Being as I have been through it myself and everyone on our board has been through domestic abuse in some way, shape or form, we are still quite triggered by stories of other people's experiences. So we're very careful to say, you know, we're not a crisis service, we're not a counselling service. What we are is we're a service that will refer you to those other services that can help you in that space. And our core offering is our women's wellbeing workshops, which we're about to launch beginning of next year for women that have been through abuse, but they've come out the other side. And although, as I said, we do market ourselves as we're not a crisis service, we naturally attract women who are trying to leave because they see my story. I'm very vocal on social media about my story and about the fact that I've come out the other side and I'm now living the life of my dreams. They see my story and they want that for themselves. So they naturally are reaching out and saying, you know, just this week I had a lady reach out and say, I need to talk to you. I'm sick of feeling the way that I feel. How can I get on a call with you? So I would say on average one woman a week I'm speaking to myself, and that's just me personally, which is too much. You know, one woman a week just in my circle is too much.
Particularly when you're not,
and it's just
promoting the charity specifically as a crisis service, you are a recovery and healing service. That, like you say, that is a lot, particularly when you're not actively promoting, we help you get out of crisis, help you deal with the authorities and things like that. It's, yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, but it just goes to show that there's a need for more services. There's a need for more support in the DV space because the services that we have available to us in Queensland and in Australia, so DV Connect is a Queensland support service and 1800 is Australia-wide. You can call that those two services 24/7, but my experience is, from what I'm hearing from other women, is that it depends who they get on the other end of that phone as to whether they get the support that they need. And when you're in that space of trauma and flight, it's really hard to have that conversation with someone that you don't know, that you can't see on the other end of a phone, and trying to explain to them what you need, because you don't know what you need until it's offered to you.
That's it. Particularly as they're operating from their fight flight, they're operating in survival. And this is even more so important why we as women need to become our own experts to an extent. Because, like you say, they don't know what they need. All they want it, all they know is they want the abuse to stop. That's it. I want the abuse to stop. And quite a common question would be, do you want to press charges? Now, this is a bit of a silly question for certainly the police to ask, really, because quite often a victim will say no, because all they want is the abuse to stop, because they know if the perpetrator isn't held accountable, that they know it will lead to consequences for them. So that's why majority of them automatically say no. But the professionals, like the police, if they know a crime's taken place, they should be acting upon that and taking that point into consideration, that actually, it's a very, very important point, is that now that we're aware of this, that victim's risk has increased tenfold. And they need to really take that into consideration with the next move that they make. And this is why they should be doing a thorough investigation, looking at the timeline, establishing what the whole picture is first, before ever going and arresting the perpetrator. Because the last thing we want to is increased risk, and that's what will happen. But actually, that's not really a question they should be asking the victim. Do you want to press charges? It should be a given. Okay, we know this is taking place. We know you're at risk. Whether we go and arrest them or not, you're still at risk. Mm. So therefore, we need to put measures in place to secure yours and your children's safety. And that's not what's happening, certainly in the UK. And, is that happening in Australia?
The responsibility is too many times put on the victim. Mm. And like you said, asking a victim, do you want to press charges? I would say no. I'm scared. If I do that, what on earth is going to happen next?
Yeah.
And I was asked on many occasions by lawyers, by judges, by police, why didn't you report this to the police? And I said to them, I was living in a house with this person. What on earth do you think would have happened if I had called the police? When the police come, they possibly don't believe me, they go away, what is going to happen next? I can tell you exactly what will happen next. I am going to pay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just don't think that they understand what they're dealing with. They really, really don't understand. And that's why I think it's so, so important that every single person in a professional sense that deals with victim survivors needs to be trained in coercive control, and they need to understand what they're dealing with, because that's the only way we're going to get change, is if they start to understand exactly what the signs are and they can advocate on behalf of these victims who can't advocate on behalf of themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's not enough just to, like we said, you know, it's not enough to just understand coercive control, because it's not black and white. They have on the psychology of the perpetrator. It's absolutely crucial. Essentially, they need to understand what makes that perpetrator tick. Because, you know, it's they can't just go off the behaviours. Sometimes they are so subtle about things. It needs the professionals to be really astute when they are engaging in those investigations and digging deep into that case.
And reading between the lines, like just exercising common sense.
Well, and this is it. This is it. And this is why you have to understand, you have to view it as a whole jigsaw puzzle. It's really important. You've got to look at it holistically. And if the victim, one of the biggest red flags is if that victim is in extreme fear, it's for a reason. It's for a reason. And that's where they, you know, they have to dig deeper. They have to, they may not have enough evidence to secure a conviction, but they have to put something in place to secure their safety, to make them feel safer. I know in the UK, it's victims are forever looking over the shoulder. I mean, there's a case that it's been in the news only yesterday on the BBC that GMP, Greater Manchester Police, and that was the force that I was dealing with, have had reports about two women that have been arrested for malicious communications because they've been ringing frantically, obviously getting really angry with the lack of productivity from the police and effort from the police to secure their safety. And so it's essentially victim blaming them. That's a classic case of victim blaming and labeling the victim as the problem. And the perpetrator coming across all calm, cool and collected. And again, that emphasizes the importance of understanding the psychology of the perpetrator.
Yeah.
We'll break for an interval now, and we will carry on with this conversation and have a chat about what Australia, because coercive control is a relatively new law in Australia, in those two states. What can they learn now that they've got this in place? What lessons can they take on board?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Stop suffering with pet-related allergies when near dogs and cats. Great news, you can feel safe around pets with Nasal Guard for pet lovers. Nasal Guard topical gel blocks pet dander, hair, and dust mites from entering your nasal passages. Try Nasal Guard for pet lovers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Love and laugh. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Kiss me quick. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back to this final part of this episode. So what lessons should all police forces across the globe take on board, but more so obviously these two states in Australia that have the coercive control law that's relatively new. And of course, you know, stalking has been a crime for quite some time in Australia anyway, they need to view that. I mean, obviously, stalking is a much easier crime to get over the line because it's any behaviour that's not wanted. Whereas coercive control is the complex one. That's the difficult one to get over the line. That's where professionals and those affected by coercive control have to work harder to prove it and get a conviction. So what lessons do you think that need to be learned?
Well, I think the number one thing that I say all the time is we need to start listening to survivors because they hold the key. They know exactly what needs to change. They know exactly how to operate and deal with these perpetrators. And I believe we really need DV advocates and trained trauma-informed support staff in all police stations and all courts. And also I would say to go as far as in mediation services as well, because I've come across a couple of women who have been through mediation recently, and I experienced it myself, where it was highlighted that there was abuse happening and it was reported to child safety that there was an incident or incidents that had occurred, which they were concerned about, but yet they still place a victim survivor and a perpetrator side by side in a room to mediate, and they expect that victim survivor to be able to advocate for themselves and to be able to cooperate. They encourage victims to cooperate with abusers and to compromise. And they need to understand that there is a massive power imbalance, and just being in a room with your perpetrator is probably the scariest thing that you will ever experience. You can't escape. You're sitting right next to them. The same in a court. You're placed almost side by side with them. And it's literally like you are in fight or flight mode, but you can't flee. You have to sit there and you have to compose yourself. And you're expected to compromise with someone who is not willing to compromise with you. And so I think the key to change everywhere is training, is awareness, is actually holding the authorities that are dealing with victim survivors accountable and insisting and making it mandatory that they complete training to understand these behaviours and to understand how victims and perpetrators present. So we were talking, you know, off air before about the Gabby Petito case. There were many survivors that watched that body cam footage of Gabby Petito being stopped by the Utah police that watched in horror. And I remember panicking, thinking, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. She's a victim of abuse.
Yeah.
And to the outside untrained eye, and I, you know, say untrained, it looks as if she's a crazy, unhinged, irrational woman, which is exactly what the perpetrator is painting her to be. And he stands there calm, cool, collected. And you just have to look at two people in a room, a victim and a perpetrator, and I can spot it a mile off. Anyone that is trained and that has experience can spot a mile off who's the victim and who's the perpetrator. But yet police and court staff, including magistrates and judges, they don't seem to have the same awareness. They don't seem to see those differences that us survivors can see. So they really need to start listening to survivors and treating what we're telling them seriously, because we've been through it. We know exactly what needs to happen. We know exactly how to change the ending. We just need people to listen.
Yeah. And the other issue that we have, again, globally, is it's not uncommon. And I know certainly in the UK, there's frequently, the Met are frequently investigating their own officers for violence and abuse-related crimes towards women. If they can relate to, as humans, we naturally are drawn to empathize with somebody who we can relate to. So us as survivors will relate to somebody who is in distress and going through and describing their experiences with an abuser. We're naturally going to empathize with them and be drawn to them. Same with a perpetrator, unfortunately. If a perpetrator can see and relate to behaviours in another perpetrator, they're naturally going to be seeking excuses and reasons for that behaviour, because and minimise that behaviour and minimise the experience of the person who's affected by it. Because by doing so, they're making excuses for themselves. So they're internally soothing their own wounds and their own guilt about their own behaviour. Because it will strike a chord. Oh, well, I behave like that. Oh, well, I need to seek excuses because I need to excuse my own behaviour. Because if I label that person as a awful human being, well, that must make me also an awful human being. And that's where professionals are supposed to detach and look at the bare facts and the bare facts alone. And that's why we're us working in this space, we have the task of detaching to a degree. And Lou's actually going to be doing my professional training to be able to risk assess shortly, which is very exciting.
How exciting.
And I'm almost done. I'm halfway through all the content. We're getting there. But as professionals, we need to detach. And as hard as that is, and look at the facts. So there are occasions where I'll have a victim, I'll be looking at a timeline, I'll be looking at what evidence there is. They'll have explained things that they've reacted to, how they've responded to that abuse. And maybe the perpetrator's caught that on video, on camera, and they've got evidence of that. If there's more evidence to suggest that the one being affected, who is a true victim, is the perpetrator, and not the actual perpetrator themselves, because remember, the perpetrator is going to come in with counter allegations, that my advice would always be, is there another way that we can secure your safety before reporting to the police? Because we need to, because you can rest assured that once a victim withdraws and removes herself and removes control, there will be retaliation. So at the very, very, very bare minimum, there's a chance of getting a conviction for a stalking offence, if not a coercive control offence. So that's where we as professionals need to weigh that up. Is there a way that we can secure their safety without involving the police first, because and avoid that escalation whilst they're still under the same roof? And is there a way for us to get an easier crime over the line? And those are the things that police, if the police have been notified, also need to take into consideration. Is there a way to secure their safety before speaking to the perpetrator, and then gather, and then maybe they may be in a position where they can gather more evidence? I think that's really, really important. And is there no, in Australia with family courts, is there no, because in the UK we have special measures. So if there's a reporter, if there's a case of domestic abuse, you can request it. You've got to request it for special measures, and they'll have screens. They'll have separate waiting rooms. Do they have that? Do they have that in Australia?
So I can only speak on the topic of magistrates' court for DVOs, because I haven't been to family court purposely. But they're just starting to put things in place. So they have safe rooms in the courthouse.
Yeah.
They have support staff from the local DV service. They recently introduced the fact that a victim doesn't need to be cross-examined. But these are all things that are, I just think, too little too late. It's taking too long to create this change, and when it does happen, it's very delayed and it's very slow, and there's no sense of urgency except from survivors. No one seems to be treating this complete crisis that we're going through throughout the world as a serious issue, and I just don't understand why.
No. So what would be your final message to, or pearls of wisdom to the professionals? What would be your pearls of wisdom that you'd like them to take on board?
I guess I would say, again, listen to survivors. Take what they're saying seriously. Just open your minds for a moment, and just, instead of discounting, not as bad as it's coming across, it's not that big a deal. Just open your mind to the fact of, okay, what if she is telling the truth? What if all of this is true? What then? Because I think if they actually stepped back and stopped downplaying things and tried to justify the reasons behind the reports and what we're saying. Just play devil's advocate. Just what if it is as bad as she says? What if it is worse than she says? Because that is often the case, is we're downplaying it because we've been taught to downplay it, and we've been taught that it's not a big deal, you're just overreacting. We've been told that time and time again. I was in the relationship for 10 years and I didn't even realise that it was happening. Little chips, little chips, little chips.
Yeah.
And so we're already downplaying it. It's already worse than what we're telling you.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
Just open your mind to, I guess, the worst case scenario. What if it's worse than what the victim survivor is reporting?
Yeah.
What are you going to do then?
Yeah, because naturally a victim does naturally downplay, and that's something they also have to take into consideration. A victim will naturally downplay. I've noticed that when I've been supporting victims, when I've been sat with them with police officers, I notice immediately they instantly go to downplaying, which is completely like it's like night and day in comparison to everything they've said to me. Yeah, without them around. So it's like as soon as they're faced with an authority figure, they downplay. It's a defense, yeah. And that's something that they have to take into consideration. And very, very quickly, if there's anything, if you were to give any advice to anybody who's still living with the perpetrator and the children are being affected, what would you say to them?
I would say reach out to a trusted friend or family member and tell them what's happening and ask them to help you to be put in contact with a service that can help you.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also good to have a safe word with that family member as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Well, thank you for joining me, Lou. It's been an amazing, amazing episode. And I shall catch my listeners on the next episode.
Thanks, Kate.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about Kate's work, head to her bio on UK Health Radio. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and always remember, you're not alone.